The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. This content is created in partnership with our sponsor, Alan Gray Australia Proprietary Limited, ABN 48112 316 168, AFSL 298487, and is limited to publicly available information. Before acting on any general advice, you should consider, whether appropriate, and obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license and does not provide any financial advice or services or endorse any general advice. If a PDS, TMD or IM exist, you should obtain a copy and review it thoroughly before making a decision.
Hi, I'm Daniel Kelly, Chief Investment Officer at Viola Private Wealth, and welcome to the Ensemble Investment Podcast. My job as guest host is to ask the right questions to the right people so you can manage your clients' money better. We have plenty to go through today, so let's jump in.
When you choose Alan Gray, you are not just buying an investment, you are buying into a distinctive investment philosophy. That philosophy is simple: to take a contrarian approach, apply it consistently, and invest for the long term. This is how we've been investing in Australia since 2006, and how the broader group has been investing globally since 1973. Our highly focused investment approach lets you take advantage of our time-tested contrarian philosophy on an Australian and global scale. For more information, go to alangray.com.au.
I'm joined by Chris Destello, Senior Investment Specialist at Alan Gray. How are you going, Chris?
Very well. Thanks so much for having me, Daniel.
No problem at all. We've got no shortage of topics to talk about today, I think, particularly with Alan Gray's investment strategy being contrarian. So, you know, we've got a bit of a scaffold to go through, but I think, you know, let's just go wherever the conversation takes us. That's always the best way.
Sounds good to me.
Take us through a little bit of the strategy that Alan Gray runs, and then I guess maybe a good place to start is, what is contrarian investing at the moment? Because that's something I've asked myself quite a lot. And I think it changes month to month at the moment, because we had US exceptionalism over, the US now looks in a strong position again. So maybe take us through your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So just to start with, I guess, who we are a contrarian manager. We're also a fundamental and long-term investment manager. And we run a few strategies in Australia. We run our fully invested equity fund, the Alan Gray Australia Equity Fund, which has 100% invested in Australian companies. We run a balance fund, which is a diversified portfolio. We lean on our sister company, Orbis, for a lot of the global holdings within that portfolio that share our philosophy. And then we have a more conservative offering relative to the others called the Alan Gray Australia Stable Fund, which is essentially a mixture of equities and cash equivalents.
Yeah.
I think the question you asked is very pertinent. You know, I think it's easier to say what is contrarian when you have a trending market.
Absolutely.
You know, when the winners keep on winning and the losers keep on losing, it's easy to say that's popular, that's not. But what we've seen in markets recently is quite a bit of reversal against the prevailing winners. So if you think about company size, you know, for a long time, big was beautiful. You had the biggest companies in Australia outperforming, the mega caps globally outperforming. Over the last 6 to 12 months, that's really started to reverse. You've had emerging markets outperforming developed markets, which is against trend. You've had value outperforming growth globally, which is definitely against trend of the last 10 years. And so that can make it a little bit more, I think, interesting and nuanced around what is out of favor and what's contrarian. I'd argue that many of those things are still contrarian because they had underperformed for such a long period of time. So certainly emerging markets are at a very large discount to other markets, trade at 16 times forward earnings relative to the US's 25 times. Value still trades at enormous discounts to their growth counterparts. And so I think those things are still contrarian, but broadly, markets are quite elevated. So I think it's important to look beneath the benchmarks and down at the individual company level.
Yeah, I feel like we've been saying markets have been elevated for like decades now, though. It always feels like we're at all-time highs, and a new all-time high is inherently necessary for the market to continue to go up, right? So I guess, you know, how do you kind of, because the strategy that you run could be quite, you know, uncomfortable to run at certain periods of time, because you're deliberately betting against some of the most kind of trends that have momentum behind them. That would take a lot of emotional resilience, I would say, you know. So what types of processes does Alan Gray, and I should say, Viola has no official connection to Alan Gray, by the way. So if we do a good job here, we may end up booking a meeting, or we might take a look at your fund. So this is an ad hoc pitch. Sure. But maybe take us through that process of how you kind of make sure that you don't get caught up with conventional thinking and you continue to kind of you know, swim against the stream, so to speak, I think is the terminology that you guys use, but also, you know, that you're not kind of barking up the wrong tree, because that could be problematic as well.
Mm, okay. So we've really constructed our entire business to allow us to be consistently contrarian, you know, and not, I guess, fall prey to conventional thinking, because it is a tough thing to do.
Mm.
Have you recently read a white paper or technical update that changed how you approach advice? Submit it to cpdcheck.com and have it recorded for CPD.
I think we were very fortunate. So our firm's been around for 20 years. It's our big 20-year anniversary in Australia this year. But we're not the... Thank you very much. But we're not the first firm. So the original Allen Gray business was established in South Africa in 1973. We had Orbis, the global investing sister company, established in 1999. And so they had already done a lot of the trial and error, and they knew what had to be put in place in terms of processes,
yeah, right,
to make this work. We were very, very lucky in that sense. And so when they launched the business, they really focused on two things, independence in decision making and alignment with our investors. And so if we look at independence, I think the major way we've done that is via our process in terms of investment decision making.
Yeah.
And we have 9 analysts based here in Sydney, just up the street. When we do stock research, it is the one analyst that is responsible for that stock research. They'll spend months on one individual opportunity. And when they've formed their view, their research, it's almost done in an academic way. That research is shared with the other 8 analysts, and they need to form their own independent review of that work.
Well, like the Beatles. That's how the Beatles work. Paul McCartney would own a song, you know, John Lennon would own a song, and then they'd share it with the other Beatles, you know, the best outcome possible. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we then get them to do is vote into a blind system, because what you don't want is someone's thinking, I'll just do what the portfolio manager wants to do, or I think that guy's the smartest in the room, I'll copy him. So they vote into a blind system, then we get in a room, we hash it out for an hour, we focus on mainly downside risks in the company.
Yeah.
And then we kind of have to go around and name and shame, and people get the chance. But it's focused on that independence and decision making. It's the same reason that the decision to include it in the portfolio is not democratic. You know, it's not 6 of the 9 said, this is a buy.
Yeah.
It goes in,
Everyone's following the managing director because they have to, because
right,
career, right? Yeah.
Right. So our managing investor, Simon, says, you know, we need one throat to choke. So ultimately it's the portfolio manager's decision of whether or not to include.
Got it.
That discussion just informs. So that's the independence piece. On the alignment piece, I think that the major way we do that is, you know, there is staff ownership of the firm. You know, senior investors and senior people in the firm do have ownership in the firm. We are a privately owned company. And we also work with performance fees. So all of our products have performance fees. When our clients do well, we do well. We structure them very fairly. They're subject to high watermark features. They're non-resettable. Mm. But I do think that sharpens the sword, because it stops, you know, once you have a lot of assets and you're just charging a base fee, the tendency can be to 100%. Shift a little bit more toward the index, right?
Yeah, we get this all the time. I get questions about fees all the time. And my response is always the same, that we're absolutely happy to pay fees. And we want the managers that we work with to have almost superhuman incentives to put their absolute maximum effort into what they're doing, because that generates the best performance outcomes. It's the same as only paying, you know, an employee or a staff member a base salary and expecting, you know, extraordinary performance. There needs to be some type of variable bonus or discretion, in my opinion, built into that compensation structure. So we're happy with fees, and it's the net of fees return, in my opinion, that you should look at.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, that philosophy extends to the way we remunerate our analysts. So typically, we pay them base salaries that are perhaps a bit below market, but they can make a lot more.
Don't tell them that. Now they know that. They're going to go to the market.
They do know that, you know. So what we do is they can, but there's a very large variable component, and it's based on the value that they add to our investors' lives, right?
Yeah.
It's based upon the alpha of the stocks that they get into the portfolio. And it's a very nice design, because if they're not adding alpha, and if they don't think they can add alpha, they're actually best served by going to another firm.
100%.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pragmatic. So you guys don't hold much of the top, you know, 10 positions or 20 positions of the ASX. You've had some really good 12-month performance. How have you done that without holding BHP and CBA is my question, because that would require, I'd imagine, some pretty big active management calls, you know, on some smaller positions. So maybe talk us through how you've navigated the last 12 to 18 months, maybe particularly the last 6, because that's kind of seen quite a bit of volatility in our market and the US market, and it hasn't been an easy stock picking environment.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of the things that have done well have been long-term positions for us. We are long-term investors. Our average holding period in our equity portfolio is a bit over 4 years. So it's a little bit less about the trading that took place in the last 6 to 12 months. And it's more about the broader market seeing the value that we were seeing in some of these positions.
Got it.
Over the last 12 months. We were positioned very differently to the benchmark. So you mentioned CBA, right? It had an incredible run. By mid last year, was close to 30 times earnings, most expensive bank in the world.
Yeah.
We didn't own a single share. And that was painful as that built up. But then CBA came off quite a bit. And it turned out we'd made the right decision for our investors.
Yeah.
At that point, at least, not to own those shares. So it was a bit about what we didn't own, which are some of these very, very large stocks that took a bit of a whack in the second half of last year. In terms of things we did own, some of the biggest contributors were things like Newmont, which is a gold producer, and gold's had a pretty amazing run. We've been selling into that. We've sold more than 75% of our shares, but it's just continued to do well.
Yeah.
And then another company would be something like Alcoa, which has evolved in the alumina and aluminium space. And aluminium prices have done fairly well, and that's seen a bit of a pickup.
Yeah, so maybe to that point, so how do you, because, I mean, obviously the audience for Ensemble is a lot of investment advisors, right? So that's kind of who we're speaking to here. How are you seeing groups using Allan Gray in their portfolio construction? Are they bolting it alongside the A200 or something like that? Because it naturally has quite a good complementary benefit with what you're doing, kind of deliberately not including the main names in the index. So maybe talk us through like how you talk to advisors about including, you know, the name in the portfolio and then also how they're using it.
That's exactly right. I mean, typically nowadays we see us being used by advisors alongside a passive approach a lot, because if you think about how passive works, all of the benchmarks that sit underneath the passive indices are market cap weighted,
yeah,
right? So you can think about the ASX 300, MSCI World, S&P, FTSE indices, you know, all the large indices are market cap weighted.
Which have done amazingly well.
They've done incredibly well. But, you know, the decision in those is simply made based on the size of the company, you know, and as something does well, it becomes a bigger part of the index. And as you're investing new incremental dollars into that approach, you're allocating more towards those things that have done relatively well.
Yeah.
We're doing the exact opposite. You know, we're typically looking at companies that have fallen in price and therefore become smaller in the index, or perhaps fallen out of it altogether and been excluded from the index, and building a portfolio in those type of names. And so it has a very powerful diversifying, or can have a very powerful diversifying effect, because it looks so different from the index. I mean, if you take our balance fund, we have none of the Magnificent Seven that have come to dominate global equity markets.
Big call, right? Like that's a big call. And like I said before, that's going to be uncomfortable at certain periods of time and then work really well in others. So that timing, I guess, would be super important.
Sure. But it's uncomfortable in a relative sense, right? If you're measuring yourself against a benchmark, which ultimately we are measured against a benchmark, but the way we invest is benchmark unaware. If we don't think something's an attractive investment opportunity, we shouldn't own it, right? And so that extends to currencies in our balance fund. At the moment, we have 1% in the US currency versus 25% for our composite index. Again, you might say, wow, that's a very different position. But if we don't think it's currently a strong store of value relative to others, you know, we'll use hedging and other things to make sure we're positioned in a way that we think investors will benefit.
That makes sense. We should probably talk about the active versus passive. Great debate, right? So I know we've talked offline a little bit about this. You know, my views is that it's not one or the other. It's both. You just need to be really deliberate and know why you're using passive in certain segments of the portfolio and why you're using active in others. I think the tendency sometimes for advisors is they feel like they're coming across as lazy to clients, which I couldn't disagree with more. I think there's no issues with having a passive index in your portfolio construction. You just need to know why it's there, why you're using it. Maybe give us your thoughts on, you know, is it one or the other, or is it both?
I don't think it's one or the other. I mean, prior to me joining Allan Gray, I was a passive investor because I didn't have the confidence that I'd be able to pick an outperforming manager. And I think passive's done a great job of getting a lot of people into markets. You know, unfortunately in Australia, only 10% of people get the benefit of seeing a financial advisor. That means 90% aren't. And so I think PASS has been a very good vehicle. And I wouldn't advocate for people wholesale changing what they're doing. But I do think it's important to have diversifying complementary exposures held alongside a passive approach, particularly in environments like today. When you look at whether it's the Australian index or the global index, they have become more concentrated over time. People may not be aware, you know, they may be thinking, I'm investing in a passive approach, so I'm getting this incredible diversification. But in the MSCI World Index, you're putting more than 70% of your money into one country, the US. The next largest country is Japan, which is 5% of that index.
I thought you were going to say NVIDIA. That's almost country. That's almost country size now.
Well, they are. They really are.
Six and a half times the ASX 200, which is just that's an incredible statistic.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And the same in Australia. You know, you have 56% or 56 cents of every dollar you put in the ASX 300 goes into materials and banks. So, you know, I think passive has done very well for people for a very long time, but I do think it's important to have some diversifying exposures held alongside, because that's what diversification is. Diversification is not having more assets. It's having assets in the portfolio that behave differently from one another.
For sure. To a point, I think sometimes diversification can get away from you. And I think just continuing to add line items as the years and years tick on, you actually end up, if you extend that to the nth degree, if you held every risk asset in the world, you'd end up with a risk-free rate and a ton of fees along the way, right?
Absolutely.
So a pragmatic approach to diversification is probably important and not pushing it too far. Maybe if we zoom out, there's a lot going on macro-wise. There's a lot of geopolitical risk, but there always is. What's the one thing that you guys are looking at the market at the moment and thinking that it has wrong? Because I think it's inherent that you kind of are looking, correct me if I'm wrong, to identify structural breaks or thesis breaks where you can go and identify companies that are being overlooked, right? So what are we all missing?
So it might be less about the positions in the way I'll answer this question and maybe a little bit more about the mindset. And it expands a little bit on what we were talking about before. You know, I think people today are very focused on relative risk and not absolute risk, right? So relative risk is the risk of underperforming a benchmark or falling behind. Absolute risk is the risk of losing money on an investment.
We define it exactly the same way.
Right. So it's natural to be taken and to focus on relative risk when the benchmarks have been so strong as they've been for the last 10 to 15 years. Now, it hasn't come in a straight line, but even the drawdowns have been relatively short-lived if you think of COVID and tariff announcements and things like that. Mm. But today, I think there are absolute risks present in the markets that people need to be aware of. So, you know, yes, markets continue to break all-time highs. Probably what's more important is their valuation relative to history. And on a forward price earnings basis, most markets across the world are elevated relative to history.
Okay, this is a really important point because I was at a JP Morgan conference probably 6 months ago, and I challenged them on this point. And my argument with this was that, you know, indexes and markets look very different 10 or 15 years ago. Like the types of companies and the types of PE ratios that those companies deserve was extremely different. If we rewound the clock even further, like a railroad business is not going to deserve to trade on an 80 times PE, right? But maybe something like NVIDIA can continue to justify that valuation premium. So my argument has been is you should be cautious of looking too far back with PE ratios and relative valuation because I think we're inherently in a different world now. And I think what we're probably going to start to see is the PE ratio of the index will continue to skew higher as we get more and more AI names because it's almost like software had a premium, AI has an even more extreme premium. So I think it's kind of it's a little bit difficult to look too far back and say that markets are cheap or expensive at the moment.
I do agree to some extent. So you're saying, you know, the businesses generally or a lot of the businesses that have become bigger, high quality, higher ROE.
More technology oriented, therefore higher PE ratios, therefore pushing earnings out, happy to run, you know, negative EBITDA for the sake of growth. Yeah.
Sure. But at some extent or at some point you do have to look at the price and even incorporating those things, we still think things have gotten a bit crazy.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, you look at the Australian index and the tech space here, obviously very small. It's not a huge part of the index, but up until recently it was trading at 100 times. Well, more than 100 times forward earnings. I mean, that is a lot of optimism impounded into share prices, a lot of frothiness. since then, you know, they've come down a bit. We've had what they're calling the SASICA, with SAS standing for software.
I thought I came up with a good title. I wrote a client note. It was called Software as a Sale. And I thought that, and then I've seen so many orientations of this.
Yeah. So look, I heard that. I can't claim that's mine. So I do agree to some extent. But then on the other side of the coin, you know, a lot of these businesses that have taken a lot of mind share do not have massive moats. You know,
yeah.
They are at risk, and these things have sold off pretty violently, both here and overseas, on the threat of AI. Because at the end of the day, it is easier to...
That's pretty good. How far are we? That was the first mention of AI. That's, yeah. I think we got 20 or 30 minutes in, so that's not bad.
You know, I think it is easier to create, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier to create an app and a technology
for sure.
solution than it is to, you know, build a mine or build an energy operation offshore or something like that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think software is going through a bit of an identity crisis at the moment, is probably what I'd call it. And businesses, I mean, software was one of the segments of the market that was the most resilient and had the largest moats because of the technical expertise, the huge amounts of money and capex that was required to build these models. And now Claude is releasing like a new model every week, it seems.
Yep.
And then that Moltbot thing that absolutely terrified markets, where it looked like that was kind of AGI emerging for the very first time. We also haven't talked about Trump. So we probably should mention the big man. Is Trump a tailwind or a headwind for you guys? Because it could be either. I guess it depends on the week and his mood. But does it make it easier, or are you looking at the volatility that he naturally brings markets? Because my view is that it's a good environment for hedge funds, long short funds, global macro funds, multi-strat funds, because one thing that's assumed with Trump is he's going to bring volatility to markets.
Mm.
And so strategies that require securities to trade away from their intrinsic value, it creates regular opportunities for that to happen, but it's not always comfortable when you're in it.
Okay, so I don't know if Trump helps or hinders a contrarian approach, frankly. You know, if I think about his first presidency, you know, I think COVID was probably a much bigger factor than anything he did in terms of investment returns. If I think about his current presidency, it's been a very good time for us, both Alan Gray and Orbis. But that's probably a bit more correlation than causation. Perhaps on the currency front, I mean, he seems pretty comfortable or even happy that the US dollar is falling relative to other currencies because it helps their exports. So maybe that's been a bit of a tailwind. We've been underweight that currency for quite a bit of time. But honestly, I'm not sure if it helps or hurts us. We are fundamental long-term investors. And so the nice thing is that we are anchored to intrinsic value. We actually intentionally don't employ macroeconomists at our firm or try and predict the timing or magnitude of macroeconomic trends or events. I'm not saying no one can do that. Don't think we have an edge.
I shouldn't say I don't think no one can do it, but it's extremely difficult.
For sure.
And I think it's more difficult now than it's ever been.
For sure.
And I think, you know, the Ray Dalio-inspired all-weather portfolio construction, the thesis that he came up with for that is his first premise was, I don't believe anybody has a competitive advantage in predicting macro environments. And even if you did, how the market's going to react to that. Because the market can sometimes do something exactly the opposite of what you thought it would do to a particular catalyst. So we build portfolios in that way as well. We build all-weather resilient portfolios. We use all asset classes, all the tools in the toolkit, because although we absolutely pay attention to the macro and we, you know, involve that in our investment decision making, but we're not tilting portfolios massively into or out of a particular market based on, you know, the macro guidance, because it's very hard to do.
Yeah, and I agree with you. More, I think it might be harder now than ever before. I mean, Trump is mercurial, so if you're investing in a macro or a geopolitical way, you need to get the call right, and the velocity of decisions being made is extreme. And then also, you might need to be right on the time period before he rolls things back, which happens pretty frequently too.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't like to be a macro-based geopolitical investment picker at the moment. I think that would be pretty tough.
Well, the good thing about being an economist is you can be wrong like 80% of the time, and you still get to keep your job, right? Because everyone's aware of how difficult it is. What about you, Chris? So how did you get into this industry? Like, let's kind of go maybe a little bit more into, you know, the man behind the decisions. What got you excited about investing? When did it start? How early was it? Maybe talk us through some of your early career, because I think some of that context is really important to building someone into who they are today, and then how they're kind of, you know, going about making investment decisions with what you're currently tasked to do.
Sure. So I'd have to credit my mother for getting me into investing, and it was quite young, although in quite a safe asset. So I was quite a good saver when I was very young. You know, when I was kind of 8, 9, 10 years old, I would ask more my aunts and my grandparents to give me cash instead of presents. And, you know, I'd saved up a little bit of money, not, I don't know, maybe $1,000 or something like that.
At 8 or 9?
Maybe. And doing jobs and things like that. Maybe not 8 or 9, but, you know, 11 or 12 or something like that. And my mother said to me, you know, Chris, if you're not going to do anything with the money, you can put it in a term deposit and you'll get a much better rate. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good deal. I'm not doing anything with it anyway.
Early term premium lesson. Yeah.
Yeah. And rates are pretty good at those days. You know, we used to go up to Bendigo Bank at Tarramurra and I liked it because it was very tangible there. We'd actually give you, it was almost like a cardboard certificate.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember it as a kid as well.
And you're getting around 7%. And so it'd say on this date, we're going to give you, I can't remember if it was a grand, but $70 if that was the case, right?
Yeah.
And you could see over time as you redid it, you were getting the impact of compound investing. So that's what kind of got me into thinking about these things. By, you know, the early 2010s, rates were very, very different following the GFC, and those TDs weren't giving you quite as much. So that's when I started to look at equity markets. And, you know, I mentioned before that you know, I was studying it and all these things, and I just didn't have the confidence in picking a winner.
Sure.
And so I invested with a passive approach for many, many years up until I joined Allan Gray in 2019.
Yeah.
And did very well with a passive approach. And then when I joined...
So you were just regularly contributing, kind of classic dollar cost averaging style?
Yeah, essentially, you know, in incredibly basic, mostly VAS or something like that.
Yeah, nice.
And when I joined Allan Gray, you know, I was quite taken with the caliber of the people I was working with. I mean, the analysts on the team are incredibly impressive people. There's multiple PhDs in hard maths and hard science. And I quickly bought into the philosophy too. And so at that stage, you know, the capital I did have mostly shifted into Allan Gray products.
Yeah.
And that's also proved to be a good decision as well.
That's one of the things I love working in finance is you're just constantly surrounded by super smart, super talented, super driven people, and it requires you to personally lift your game. You
know? Exactly.
Because the industry, and I've said it before, wealth management and investment management in Australia is really high standard. You know, it really is at a global standard. So, you know, we've got to make sure we keep showing up and giving our best selves, otherwise we'll be left behind.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, they say, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. Right? And at Allan Gray, when I sit in these meetings when we're deciding the companies we're going to purchase, I definitely feel like the dumbest person in the room. And I think that's why I love coming to work, because I love learning. And there's always something to learn. I mean, it's incredibly exciting to come in and work in that space.
So what do you do outside of work? And then one of the things I love to ask people and think about is, what is something that you do outside of work, maybe a hobby or a personal passion or something like that? And how does that help you with your career? Because I've found over the last, you know, 18 to 24 months, I'm noticing a lot of correlation. So I play in a band, I play music, noticing a lot of, you know, similarities between principles in music and principles in investing.
Okay.
Sometimes more complex is not better. A more complex song is not always the one that people want to listen to. A simple melody is sometimes the best. And that is often true with an investment strategy as well. So is there anything that you kind of do outside work that you kind of particularly bring inside, you know, the deal floor?
Sure. But maybe before I jump in, what do you play?
I sing and play guitar in a rock band. So So music Daniel predates finance Daniel by many years. So I went to a music high school in year 11 and 12.
Okay.
I went to the Australian Institute of Music. We still play gigs regularly. It's just that the Sydney music scene sucks. Mm. It's so bad.
Right.
I mean, if it was LA or kind of anywhere in California, it'd be different. But actually, one of the great venues, you know, Frankie's Pizza is up the road from here, is closed down. So there's not that many places to play, unfortunately. But
I used to play bass in a band, but I was absolutely terrible.
No way.
Basically, I was just spending so much time with mates who are actually quite decent musicians.
Yeah.
They said, Chris, we don't have a bass player.
You've got to get a finance band together, because I'm constantly, because the boys from Equity Mates, they're also jazz musicians, which is incredible. We might have to get a band together.
That was a long time ago, but we used to play a couple of gigs on Oxford Street and do
nice stuff. Yeah.
But okay, so to your question, my passions today. So I'm a very keen fisherman.
Oh, nice. That's super unique.
I do a lot of fishing. My dad runs a small fishing tackle company. And so, you know, I do also have two very young daughters, a 2-year-old and a 3-month-old. So the type of fishing I'm doing has changed a bit. But I love all fishing. So it was going offshore or off the rocks. And now it's, you know, taking my daughter, my 2.5-year-old, down to Bobbin Head and fishing for brim.
Yeah, nice.
So does it help my career? I think so, but only in the sense of I find it, you know, incredibly relaxing and a nice detachment and a chance to switch off. Yeah, so it probably helps me in that way, just because it's something that I truly enjoy doing and find very relaxing. And
my family was just making fun of me on the weekend. We were at the Bathurst 12-hour, and I had a habit when I was young, when I was like 8 or 9, we'd all be fishing. There'd be like 6 lines in the water, and I'd just cast across everyone and tangle every single one of us. And so they kind of reminded me that I did that pretty regularly. So I'll send this clip to them and say, you know, I'm taking accountability even now. But
the most hated guy in the wharf.
I was, for sure. What do you find is the main difference? Because you've got, I guess, two groups of prospective clients for your funds. You've got institutional investors and you've got the wealth management channel.
Mm.
Two very different pools of capital, two very different sets of requirements. What do you find when you're in the room? Because a lot of this game is raising money for the funds, right? If we're honest with ourselves, performance is really important, but actually kind of getting awareness for the products, you know, speaking to people about it, educating them, making them aware of it is also 50% of the work or more, I'd say. What do you notice is the main difference between talking to clients like us in the wealth management channel versus those kind of insto, you know, counterparties?
Sure. So, I mean, it is important to raise capital because you can't benefit investors
if you
don't have anything to invest. You know, I think there's maybe less difference than you think. I think, you know, obviously it's a spectrum, but I think a lot of advisors are incredibly sophisticated in their thinking and in the depth of research they do. Our packs that we take to these meetings are actually not, at least mine, are not substantially different, whether I'm going to meet with an institutional client or meet with an advisor. Perhaps the main difference in those conversations is that a lot of our long-standing institutional clients, you know, large super funds and the like, have just known us and been invested with us for so long that they deeply understand what we do and they know what they expect from us. And so it's more about, what are you currently thinking? What are the changes in the portfolio? What do you think about this? Whereas with advisors, even if they've been invested with us for a couple of years, it's still that education piece. It's still, you know, this is how we implement.
Sure.
This is how business is set up. This is why we work in this way.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. What's the one question that you hate answering in a pitch? What's the most frustrating question that you kind of get regularly that you think, oh, this is so obvious to understand, but people kind of, you know, continue to harp on that? Is it about fees? Is it about management fees or performance fees?
Maybe about fees and performance. I mean, I think the best conversations are where you're getting away from performance and talking about what you're thinking and the individual investment opportunities and these kind of things. No one should be investing based on performance.
Or performance alone, right? Like, it's the thesis on strategy.
Of course, it's important to look and see if a manager has delivered outperformance for clients over a long period of time. We should not exist unless we can do that. So, of course, that's important.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't get below that headline level, I don't think it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
On the fees piece too, I would agree. I mean, some people are opposed to performance fees, for example, because, you know, we appreciate for advisors, it's a little bit more complicated in terms of the SOA. You know, the ICR can change relative to just having one that's permanently set. But I think the benefits outweigh the negatives, honestly.
Absolutely.
What we talked about before, sharpening alignment, making sure we have an incentive to protect our capacity, protect our ability to generate alpha for clients. And so sometimes conversations can get bogged down on fees a bit too. When I think, you know, it is net of fee performance that makes the difference, and that's important.
Could not agree more. And I think too many advisors focus on fees. It's important to make sure that you're not paying more than you need to. But sometimes for the best fund managers in, you know, certain asset classes, paying fees is just a ticket to the game. And like you said, it's the net of fees return that is actually the thing that compounds the client's money. So, you know, if you want to be too cheap on fees, it's not necessarily in the client's interest in many circumstances as well. We've gone through a lot. What I wanted to do was finish up with a few quick fire questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got 5 or 6 for you. First thing that comes into your mind, and then we'll kind of just wrap up with a summary. but who is your all-time favorite investor?
Okay, I think maybe people would expect me to say Buffett or something like that as a contrarian value manager, but I'll say Jim Simons.
Okay.
I don't know if you know Jim Simons.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Yep. Renaissance Technologies, mathematical genius, chain smoker.
Yeah.
You know, maybe has the best
old school Wall Street.
pretty incredible guy. Yeah.
Fantastic. If you had to pick between EQ or IQ, specifically with investing, which one would you go with?
IQ for investing.
Yeah.
EQ for pretty much everything else.
EQ for relationships.
IQ for investing.
If you weren't an investment specialist, what would you be doing?
If I wasn't an investment specialist and I had zero responsibilities, I'd probably be, you know, fishing. I'd be running a charter operation out of Vanuatu or far north Queensland or something like that.
Yeah, nice. If you could give one piece of advice to your 25-year-old self, or maybe earlier for you because you started at 8 or 9, what would it be?
Is it tricky? Maybe it would be, if I think about my own investing experience, you know, maybe it would be that tax should factor into your investment decision making, but it shouldn't dictate what you're doing. You know, no one likes to lock in capital gains, but sometimes you need to in order to move on to a more attractive investment opportunity. And maybe it's played too much of a role for me personally in the past in terms of slowing down the velocity of that movement of capital.
Classic saying, tax is an outcome, not a strategy, right? Your favorite band or musician and why?
Probably Metallica.
Oh, okay. It's like, yeah, mine too.
Dead set.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Did you see them when they came out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not bad for a bunch of 65
casual thing. Amazing. Yeah. So, you know, me and my mates, we always go when they come out to Australia. I'm not as obsessive as one mate. He goes to Sydney and then he flies down to Melbourne and goes, the set list is a little bit different.
Super fan.
Big time. But yeah, we love Metallica.
Oh, man. 1989, Seattle, one of the greatest concerts of all time. A book, podcast, or documentary recommendation for everyone.
Yeah, so a book I read recently was a book called, what was it called? Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, I think. And it was a very interesting book. It's about decision-making and probabilistic decision-making. It sounds boring, but she's an ex-professional poker player and provides a very, very good framework for decision-making in markets and in everyday life. And I'd highly recommend that one.
Fantastic. I think... yeah, a certain amount of understanding of probability embedding is inherent in what we do, right?
Yeah, I think what she gets at is that, you know, in investing and in life, you can make the right decision and have it not go right. These things are probabilistic, right? So if you go into a decision and you think this is right or this is wrong and it's going to be my fault if it's wrong, that's actually the wrong framework to make a decision.
For sure.
You shouldn't be making decisions based on probabilities. What's the chance of this going right? What happens if it goes right? What happens if it goes wrong?
It's what my CFA professor always used to say. He said, you'll be right in your thesis and wrong on your timing almost every time. You need both.
Who was your professor? Mark Meldrum or something?
Mark Meldrum. It was. Oh, yeah. So I spent thousands of hours with his voice in my head.
Me too. Me too.
He brought personality to sometimes some extremely dull topics, which I was very appreciative of. And so I still get people, I left a ton of comments on the CFA forum.
Did you?
Yeah. So I still get people reaching out to me kind of, you know, asking for advice and things like that. But Mark's an absolute legend.
I still listen to him. He does these.
Yeah.
Not every week, but he has a fantastic YouTube.
Absolutely. I'll actually put that in as my own, you know, recommendation. Just YouTube Mark Meldrum.
Mm.
Super funny guy. Extremely intelligent. He's a PhD himself. And he runs, in my opinion, the best CFA prep course. So for any CFA students, level one, level 2, level 3 students out there, go and check out Mark. Yeah, he was a godsend.
Mm.
Thanks for coming in, Chris. That was fantastic. Very insightful. I think what you guys do has never been needed more than in the current market environments. And it's absolutely something that investment advisors should consider an allocation to. So, you know, if someone's interested in learning more, how do they reach out and find you guys?
Yeah. So our website, they can just type Allan Gray Australia into Google. Our contact numbers are there. We have our BDMs there, but my email and my number's there too. So anyone can just reach out directly to me too if they had a question or wanted to catch up.
Fantastic. Thanks for dialing in. I'm Daniel Kelly from Viola Private Wealth. We'll see you in the next one.